Okay, our next speaker, Professor Andy Pittman, is a professor in climate science at the University of New South Wales. He's the director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science. He has broad interests in extending across climate modelling, climate change, climate impacts and land cover change. He was a lead author on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change third and fourth assessment reports, and is a review editor of the fifth assessment report. He won the New South Wales Climate Scientist of the Year in 2010 and won both the Priestley Medal and the Australian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society Medal. He was appointed to the Australian Federal Government's Science Advisory Panel to the Climate Commission in 2011. Please join me in welcoming Andy. Andy Pittman.
So, good morning. I'm going to give you a 25-minute rundown on some of the science around climate. Will gave me a brief that would take about 3 days, which is a fair challenge to condense into 25 minutes, but I'll give it a go. So I'm going to talk about these things, which you've been reading about for as long as most of you can remember in the newspapers and hopefully in the scientific literature. So quick rundown on the latest global science. A quick rundown on some of the drivers of climate change over Australia, particularly greenhouse gases and modes of variability, and then a quick talk through on some of the things in the future. So, first of all, emissions. Emissions are increasing. Everything you've ever heard about efforts to reduce global emissions of greenhouse gases has not worked. We are continuing to increase greenhouse gases. The dots on here running from 1990 are observations. So back in 1990, we emitted roughly 6 billion tonnes of CO2 into the atmosphere. That's roughly 6 cubic kilometres of coal vaporised on an annual basis and emitted into the atmosphere, which is pretty impressive. We increased up to around 7 billion tonnes in 2000. We tracked up here. This is the GFC, which gives you a sense of how big an impact the GFC had on global carbon emissions and another sense of how big a task it is to turn this down to zero emissions, which is down here somewhere. We're now up around 10 billion tonnes a year, despite all of the efforts which we've heard about to reduce emissions. The various lines on here were created in about 2000 as scenarios for how greenhouse gases might increase in the future. So if we went heavily renewable, heavily nuclear, got global population growth under control, and distributed technologies to reduce emissions globally to developing countries, we could get down to this emissions trajectory. Note that emissions trajectory is still going up. Business as usual, A1B, which is was believed to be pretty much technically impossible because we didn't have the capacity to dig stuff out the ground that fast and burn it, turns out with human ingenuity to be manageable pretty much, and we seem to be doing it pretty well. As a consequence of that, stuff's happening. Sea levels are rising. This is global sea level. The fact that the global sea level is rising does not mean that every single beach in the world is necessarily seeing sea level rise. It's like your share portfolio. You hope your share portfolio overall increases over time. You probably don't stress too much if one individual share within your portfolio drops. And it's the same with global sea level rise. It's not sea level rise on every beach. Global sea level rise has risen by about 0.19 metres over the 20th century. On here are multiple estimates from tide gauges and physical monitoring of sea level. And up here, the red, is satellite measurements. Please don't ask me how satellites measure sea level to within a millimetre accuracy, because I don't understand the technology. I just believe that engineers are pretty smart at doing these sorts of things. And the satellite observations of sea level rise match the usual physical way of measuring sea level around the world. These are global observations all over the place. There has been an acceleration in the rate of sea level rise, which is unusual. It hasn't happened often in the last 2,000 years, but we don't know if that acceleration is due to global warming. It might be natural processes accelerating the rise over the last decade or so, last couple of decades. But the overall trend, this overall trend, is now clearly attributable to global warming. It's also getting hotter. You may know that we have just gone through the longest heat wave in Sydney's history. Australia has been beating records with a La Nina, or neutral conditions. We normally beat temperature records during El Niños, and we are now going into an El Niño. So these are decadal average temperatures back to 1850, and it warmed rapidly in the 1930s, as many of you know, stabilized a little bit in the 50s, and then warmed rapidly over the last few decades. And as far as we know, the rate of warming is accelerating, and we know that the last three decades have been successively warmer at the Earth's surface than any preceding decade since 1850, and we stop in 1850, not because it was hotter back then, but the data don't let us make these kinds of analyses back earlier than 1950, because there weren't many thermometers prior to 1950. We can also look at that at a finer temporal resolution. So looking now at annual resolution of data, again back to 1850, there are three data sets on here. And the reason I'm showing that there are three data sets is there is uncertainty in the observed data. If you look really closely, you can see places where the lines aren't identical. There's a little dot just there, if I can hold my hand still enough. That is the uncertainty in the data. There are uncertainties in the data, and they are tiny in comparison to this trend. This trend here, when people in physics take all the data and reprocess it because they think the climate scientists have got it wrong, find out that they think the climate scientists have underestimated the trend, and that if you go read online about the best project, you can find people who've been doing that work. So global temperature has now risen by about 0.89 degrees since the start of the 20th century. I think it's about 4 degrees temperature between an ice age and an interglacial. So we're talking astronomically large amounts of warming having occurred on, in terms of the Earth's the planet Earth, infinitesimally short period of time. The rate of warming seen here is probably unprecedented, but we can't be sure about whether it has occurred naturally in the past at this scale for brief periods of time. It's only in the averages that we've seen a brief pause. So this is the so-called warming hiatus. So if you draw a linear line through this, which you shouldn't do because there's not enough data, it's relatively flat. And if we go to look at the extreme temperatures, there is no flattening. So we've been warming rapidly, and the red line is the maximum temperatures global. We've been warming rapidly in the maximum, the red line, and that increase in maximum temperatures has not slowed over the last decade or two, but the averages have slowed for reasons that we understand now. This is a worry because not many of you recognize changes of half a degree or a degree in the mean. But if you remember back to being in Melbourne when it hit 48 degrees and you add a few degrees on top of that, because the maximums are warming faster than the means, you start to get some really frightening temperatures. And this is what happens when you get really frightening temperatures. The railway lines buckle because those little gaps put between railway lines as thermal expansion joints don't turn out to be wide enough for a 48 degree day. So the railway lines expand, the expansion joint closes, and the rails continue to expand and they buckle. And that cost quite a lot of money. And we expect the frequency of those sorts of events to increase quite significantly in the future. This is the trend in extreme temperatures. These are heatwave events going back in time to the 1960 to 70, 70 to 80, etc., etc. There's been roughly a doubling in the frequency of heatwaves over that time period, and that doesn't include the last few years where Australia has been beating records extraordinarily impressively by a huge amount. The recent heatwave in Sydney, I think, was roughly twice as long as the previous record. That is like a long jumper beating the world record long jump by a factor of 2. And I think you'd ask some serious questions about what they were taking if they did that, which is exactly what we're saying about the climate. We're basically putting the climate on a performance-enhancing drug. This heat wave in the southern cities killed about 200 people. The people I talk to in the medical community talk about harvesting, which I find quite distasteful. These were people who were harvested by the heat wave and would not have died otherwise, because the death rates post the event didn't drop down below the long-term average. So these were people who were dying that would not have died in the near term had there not been the heat wave. Heat waves are being observed. This isn't about modeling. This is boring observations. Are being observed to be occurring earlier. They are observed to be becoming more intense, and they are observed to be becoming longer. If we move into the modeling space, we expect those things to continue with a doubling of heat waves by 2030 and a tripling by 2070. If you look at other extreme events like bushfire risk, this is from 1975 up to 2009, I think, and it looks at the evolution of the risk in the Forest Fire Danger Index, which is a measure of fire risk, in the 90th percentile, so the extreme end of the distribution of possible fire danger indices. That's the wrong button. And each of these lines is a single observational record from a place in Southeast Australia, and the dash and the average of all of the stations over Southeast Australia is the thick black line, and then we've just put a simple linear regression through that, and it's pretty simple that there is a slow upward trend in bushfire risk. And that isn't about modelling, that's about observations. If we move to cyclones, life becomes a bit more trying. The yellow lines on here are the number of non-severe cyclones, and the red are the number of severe cyclones since the 1970s up to the present time. And I'll talk about projections of cyclones in a few minutes. But the short story is, because they're rare, we don't have a good enough statistical sample to reliably say what's happening with the frequency of cyclones or the intensity of cyclones. There are hints of a reduced frequency, but an increased intensification, but the scientific literature is unquestionably unclear about that. So I wouldn't gamble a case of Grange on what was happening with cyclone intensity or cyclone frequency. This is back to that diagram showing the warming in the mean temperatures since 1850. And I just want to quickly break this apart for you. This is the hiatus. People have gotten terrifically excited about the fact temperatures appear to have stabilized over the last 15 years without remembering that similar time periods, it cooled and it cooled and it cooled quite a bit by 0.2 degrees. These were coincident with high aerosol loadings and La Nina conditions, amongst other things, including sunspot cycles. We have just been through a long period of solar minimum, a long La Nina period, and quite high aerosol loadings over quite large parts of the world. And for those of us in climate science, we're not concerned that it stabilized. We're terrified that it didn't cool by 0.2 degrees. We should have seen substantial cooling over the last 10 years, and we haven't. We've seen a stabilization of temperatures. And that's really unusual, given the aerosols, the La Nina, and the stage we've been in the solar cycle. So we anticipate, as we move into an El Nino, this going rapidly back up, but it may not go back up in 1 year or 2 years. But the overall trend is pretty clear. I can also focus on variability, the wiggles in these lines that people on some dodgy radio stations get terrifically excited about. This is about variability. It's driven by the El Niño Southern Oscillation, ENSO. It's driven by the Indian Ocean Dipole, the Southern Annular Mode. It's also driven by a whole range of other modes of variability, like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. These drive temperature variability on timescales of decades, even if there is a long-term upward trend driven by greenhouse gases. The overall trend here, and I haven't fitted this red line with anything more complex than PowerPoint, is upward, but in the same way as your superannuation you hope increases in value over time, and you're told that if it drops for a year or two, don't stress, because it's a long-term investment. It's the same with global warming. Global warming is a long-term investment, in inverted commas, driven by slowly accumulating greenhouse gases, gradually increasing the forcing, the amount of energy, in the climate system. And it drives an upward trend unless the laws of physics are wrong. Whereas, against that long-term trend, we see noise and variability driven by ENSO, Indian Ocean Dipole, Southern Annular Mode. So these are really important if you want to know what's going to happen to climate over the next 3, 5, 10 years. They aren't that important to climate if you want to know what the planet's going to look like in 2050. So what are they? These are the modes of variability, the large scale, continental scale, subcontinental scale drivers of climate over Australia in time and space. But they only explain 30 to 50% of the variability. So if we go into a strong El Niño, which it looks like we're doing, that strong El Niño will only explain, on average, 30 to 50% of the consequential variability. So you can have cold, wet El Niños and hot, dry La Niñas, but on average, El Niños are hot and dry in the East Coast, and La Niñas tend to be cooler and more moist. We don't know how these things will change in the future. We're working on it very hard, because what we really want to be able to do is what's called decadal predictability, which is to say in with precision how the climate will change over the next 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years. At the moment, how all of these change, and critically, how they interact, because they operate on different timescales, and you will see a severe drought when an El Niño aligns with the right phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation with the right phase of the Indian Ocean Dipole, and when they're contradicting themselves in terms of their influence on the climate, you may not see strong influences from an El Niño. How all those interact is one of the grand challenges in my research field. So, back to this slide. What's going on timescales of 1 to 7 days ain't my problem. That's the Bureau of Meteorology. They do it really well. They are far better at forecasting than they used to be. They used to be pretty good. And don't believe the discussions over the barbecue that they're no better than a parrot talking about sequential warm or cold days. The Bureau are now doing really impressive forecasting. Up to many months is called seasonal prediction. It's driven by the modes of variability, the ENSO cycle, the Indian Ocean Dipole, etc. Once you get up to a decade or so, that's decadal prediction. And now we see interactions between the modes of variability and the greenhouse forcing. Now it's a convolution of multiple drivers on the climate, which makes it very much harder. And once you go past decades to 20, 30, 50 years, we're into the climate prediction space. And at those timescales, what goes on is primarily driven by the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So, greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere matter on longer timescales. Here is what happened to temperature over the last 1,500 years. We were very, very slightly cooling. Industrialization, warming up to 0.89 degrees, and then when we move into the future, it does not depend so much on what I do in terms of the science. It depends critically on what we choose to do as a species. It depends on which emissions future we follow. Do we decide we're going to have very relatively low emissions and really keep greenhouse gases down towards the lower end of what's feasible, in which case we might warm by 2 degrees? Or do we go up to business as usual, keep doing what we're doing, where we might see warming of 5 degrees or 6 degrees? The uncertainty is about emissions, primarily, not about the science in climate. But there is some of that. So each of these shows approximately the uncertainty for a given emission scenario. So if we follow this green emission scenario, associated with that is some uncertainty from the climate science, and it's probably a degree. If we follow this larger emission scenario, there is uncertainty of about a degree. But the overall range, the big uncertainty from 1.5 to 5 degrees or whatever, is primarily dependent on which choice we take as a species in terms of emissions. So, if you also want to know how climate will change at regional scales, specifically at regional scales, you have to also know about the timing of the modes of variability as they interweave themselves with the CO2 and methane forcing. And that is rocket science. And we don't have that capacity for all variables at the present time. So if you keep emitting greenhouse gases, you will also lead to a rise in sea level. The amount that sea level rises is dependent upon the emission scenario. So low emissions, this blue, sea level of 0.5 meter. High emissions, red, sea level up towards more towards 1 meter. It's basic, fairly basic thermodynamics. It's not particularly challenging to do. If you warm the planet, you will melt the ice sheets. And we probably now have already gone past the point at which Greenland is gone. But it might take a millennia before that happens. So we're not suggesting Greenland will be gone by Thursday afternoon. My rule of thumb in all of this is I think we should be assuming a 1 meter rise in sea level by 2100, purely on the grounds that that's a good, nice round number. It's probably slightly on the high side. It takes a little bit of the storm surge into account. And if I'm wrong and Greenland does melt more quickly, you've built a little bit of risk into the system. I love sea level rise because I don't work on it, so I rely on really good groups like the ACRC down in Hobart. And here's some really fascinating numbers that they put out into the literature a few years ago. Assume a 0.5 meter sea level rise. A once per decade event becomes roughly 1,000 times a decade more frequent, starts to happen 1,000 times a decade every 3 days. So an event that used to happen once every 10 years starts to happen every 3 days. A once in 100 year event starts to happen 10 times a year. I found those numbers completely bizarre and ridiculous. So I went and checked. And it's right. If you see 0.5 meter rise in sea level, an event that has the probability of occurring once in 100 years starts to happen 10 times a year. Just because the means have increased into an environment where we built resilience to withstand the high tide. And if the high tide goes up a little tiny bit, you have a profoundly big impact on some coastal development. So I live in Pymble, and I'm hoping for sea views before I sell. Future tropical cyclone activity, this is a little bit noisy. This is the change in the frequency of all cyclones, the change in the frequency of cyclones with a 4 to 5, the change in the maximum intensity, and the change in the rainfall rate. And in my view, if you look at all of those, you end up with the conclusion that it's not clear what happens in the future around any of those variables, and it's highly regionally specific as to whether things will increase or decrease, whether they'll become more intense or less intense, etc., etc. I think the jury is still out on what will happen to cyclones by 2030, 2050. It's really hard. So confidence in this projection stuff. The global projections of what will happen were sorted in about 1970. And we really haven't changed all that much since 1970. You literally can get a first-year undergraduate with half of your mathematical talent to do it on the back of an envelope. Once we move down to continental scales, it gets kind of harder, but the scale of the physical modeling that is done nowadays has pretty well resolved what will happen at continental scales. Once we get down to the state scales, it's developing. There is skill now. It's very well done for temperature and heat waves. It's much harder for rainfall. But once you get down to the scale of, say, Sydney, we really are struggling to resolve all of the complex interactions that lead us to knowing how climate will change over a scale the size of Sydney. So as we move from the global scale down to the local scale, our skill decreases. Now, I'm perfectly aware that its value decreases as you go from the city up to the global. You guys want to know what might happen at the scales that you have portfolios or you manage risk. And it's not that we're lazy. It's really hard to get down, to these scales in a global model. So we now use petascale supercomputing and produce multiple petascale data sets on the biggest supercomputers in the world. And we can get down to this sort of spatial resolution with some skill. I think most of us will retire before we're confident down at that scale. So the science situation tells us at the rate that we're emitting, we are not on track for warming of 2 degrees. That is what the European community defined as safe, which is a bizarre number, because you might have noticed extreme events increasing globally with 0.89 degrees of warming. And if it's dangerous at 0.89, I find it logically difficult to believe it's safe at 2 degrees, but just let's accept 2 degrees as a number. If you want a 75% chance of not going above 2 degrees, and we grow emissions at 3.5% per year, the carbon budget runs out in 2021. Yeah, I do know it's 2014, and I do know it's not long till 2021. If we can reduce emissions at 2% a year, which we noticeably aren't doing, our carbon budget runs out in 2030, et cetera, et cetera. This is not a budget like the federal budget that increases year by year. This is a hard budget, a permanent forever, never emit any more carbon when you reach that budget. And I think that's implausible. I think snowball's chance in hell is the phrase I would use of us avoiding 2 degrees. I think we're going way above 2 degrees, and I suspect plausibly to 4. And I think in the context of not turning emissions around, we ought to start thinking about and planning for the consequences. And the short story, the take-home message, is we need to be building significant investment in resilience, minimizing vulnerability, and developing a really good understanding of our vulnerability to climate and planning for very significant climate change, because it's coming. I think you're already seeing it, and it's likely to get significantly worse. So in conclusion, in terms of our skill in simulating future climate change, it depends intimately on what you want your predictions for. If it's about temperature, sea level rise, or ocean acidification, it's pretty straightforward. We're also quite clear that extremes are occurring faster than the averages. And we're also pretty clear that there's an intensification of rainfall and bushfire risk is increasing in Australia at least. But certain other variables that really matter to you, like cyclones, and in particular hail, we really have no good knowledge of how those things will change with any level of reliability. I think there's one paper published on hail, and in my field, you need dozens before you begin to think that the results might be right. You can do stuff around this case by case. You can do intimate studies of particular phenomena in particular places and get better knowledge, but they have to be done case by case, really carefully. The good news, because it's always nice to end on a good news story, is it's emissions that control the scale of sea level rise, the scale of changes in temperature, the scale of changes in heat wave events, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And emissions are up to us. So we can solve this problem. It just requires global agreements to cut emissions. Thank you.
So are you scared yet? Does anyone have a quick question for Andy? I know there will be a lot, but we're going to get them back up in a minute. Go on, Sharon Jade.
Can you tell me about your funding outcomes for the next budget?
My personal funding's fine for another 5 years, but in general, the most important thing is the cuts to the ARC. I personally think the cuts to the CRC program, I don't work with industry, but there are lots of groups that do work quite closely with industry and are beginning to get really strong relationships, and the loss of the CRC program helps build chasms between the scientific community and the business community, which seems to me to be a bizarre thing to be doing. There were fairly significant cuts to CSIRO, as many of you will have heard, but not particularly aggressively in my space. And I think the Bureau of Meteorology got significant funding for ensemble weather prediction and extremes predictions, which is a good news story for most of the people in the room. So if you do a weather forecast, the Bureau used to do a forecast, and they will be able to now do many, many forecasts of an event with perturbed initial conditions, perturbed physics representations, etc., to give probabilities of events as distinct from their best estimate of the event. So it's not all bad news by any stretch of imagination, but in the ARC and the CRC programs, it's not good. I'm actually much more concerned, if anybody cares, about deregulation of university fees, because we need kids to not go and become actuaries when they finish their degrees, but do something useful in climate science.
Okay.
Because what we do is mathematics and physics, and I can't see how anyone will be able to afford to do a PhD at the end of their undergraduate degree, and that scares the hell out of me.